Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. Tonight, rap feuds don't often make headlines around the world, but this one involves two of the biggest and most influential names in hip-hop. In fact, Toronto's Drake is one of the biggest names in music, period. So how did this beef between Drake and LA's Kendrick Lamar begin? How did it go from slow simmer to downright vicious over just a few weeks? We find out. For decades, Ken Smith lived completely off the grid in the Scottish Highlands. Now, his story is being shared in a new book called The Way of the Hermit. And Canada played a really pivotal role in shaping his journey. Co-author Will Millard is with me to share that story. He is one of the most astute political commentators in this country, and now Paul Wells has turned his sights on the Prime Minister and his fast rise to power and steady fall in popularity over the past few years. His book is called Trudeau on the Ropes, and he joins me to tell me all about it. But first, he went from hero in just 9.79 seconds to villain a few days later when he was disqualified from the 1988 Olympics in Seoul for testing positive for steroids. So how does Ben Johnson look back at that time? What's his life been like since? And why is he still trying to clear his name? He's with me to answer those questions and more. Let's start with sports, though. This is an interview that we've been working on for the past few weeks since we interviewed Mary Ormsby, the Toronto's former Toronto Star sports writer, who's just written a book about Ben Johnson and that famous 1988 race in Seoul. Remember that? September 24th, 1988? It was, at the time, at least for a few days, one of the most magical moments in Canadian Olympic history. Just 12 years after coming off no gold medals at the Olympics in Montreal in 76, the nation celebrated as one as Ben Johnson raced to victory in the 100 meters.
The gold medalist, Ben Johnson, Canada.
Ah, what a cool moment that was. The Canadian blew away longtime rival Carl Lewis, clocked an astounding time of 9.79, a world record very briefly, and took the title of fastest man on earth. But the joy and the celebration, as you will remember, flew by almost as quickly as that race did, with rumors already flying around. And a few days later, after that incredible win, Johnson and Canada would come crashing down to earth. A positive test for a banned substance meant disqualification for Johnson, despondency for the country. Here's that now famous press conference given by IOC media officer at the time, Michel Verdier.
The IOC Medical Commission recommends the following sanction: disqualification of this competitor from the Games of the 24th Olympiad in Seoul.
And that was it. I mean, you must remember Johnson returning home, the anger that surfaced after that. And although there are still questions lingering about how exactly Johnson tested positive in Seoul and originally denied that he had been taking performance-enhancing drugs, he would later admit it at the Dubin Inquiry, that commission into the use of drugs and banned practices intended to increase athletic performance, that he admitted that he did indeed knowingly take performance-enhancing drugs beginning in the early 1980s on the advice of his longtime coach, Charlie Francis.
I remember the first time we discussed drugs is when he came outside the fence where I was training, and he talks about the only word is using drugs and the only way I'm going to get better is to take it. And at the time, I didn't say yes or no.
Right, but he did admit at the inquiry to taking performance-enhancing drugs. End of story for most of us, right? He cheated, he got caught, and that was it. While this is all fading into memory, don't forget, it's been 36 years this September since Seoul. Johnson himself is 62 now. A new book looks back at Johnson's remarkable rise and spectacular fall and charts what's happened to him since. We spoke with Mary Ormsby about her book, The Fastest Man on Earth, Asterix, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson, a few weeks ago. Here's what she had to say.
Even though it doesn't mean an endorsement of his behavior, I think as Canadians and people who believe in the right to due process can understand that he did not receive a fair hearing back in 1988. And possibly, if you're open-minded, there should be a way for the government or sport officials in Canada to review his case.
Mary Ormsby talking about her book, The Fastest Man on Earth, Asterix, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson, on the show a few weeks ago. You can always find those interviews at alittlemoreconversation.com, by the way. After listening to Mary tell that story and realizing what a difficult story it still remains for many Canadians to even talk about. We thought we'd reach out to Ben Johnson himself and find out what he had to say, because clearly he took part in this book, and he's hoping, after all this time, still hoping that he can redeem himself in the eyes of the rest of us. And he joins me now. Ben Johnson, thank you.
Thank you.
So, I mean, all of a sudden there's a book out. You're talking. Here we are, 36 years later. What would you like people, why did you feel like this was the right time to tell your story again?
Because the story didn't was told. The story was only told one way, by the media and by the government. Mm-hmm. But now we want to set the record straight for the audience or the public to really know what was the real truth is and what's been going on behind the scene.
Take me back to that moment in 1988, because me, like so many Canadians, I sat there and I watched you win. What was it like to run that race? Because it was a magical moment.
Well, you know, you spend your whole life training to do something that you love, something that you like, and something that you can always say, you know, I did it. And, you know, came back from Jamaica here as a young boy, trained for rigorous training for about 13 years to be the best I can be at that moment, over and over, the agony, the pain, the suffering, the sweat, the tiredness. It was great. I make it look easy, but it was all worth it.
Yeah. Did you know from the get-go? I mean, you had a great start. Did you know that you were going to win?
Well, since the gun goes off and I react, I know that it was a great start. It was a fast start, and no one has a move out of the block. So I know in my mind, I say, this is a good start. This is going to be a world record. Let's keep running.
Yeah. So you, I mean, what was it? There was so much elation, and I knew you felt it from Canada, and I knew you obviously felt it from the crowd, and it was just such a magical moment for a lot of people. Do you think back to that moment at all? Do you remember that moment? Was it all erased afterwards, or do you remember that moment?
I never erased it, because as a young boy, like I said, I trained for 13, 14 years to be the best I can be on that day, and that day was Ben Johnson Day. And I did it. I win the gold medal for a lot of people. And the gold medal was mostly for my mother.
Yeah, you and your mom were very, very, very close, right?
Yeah, very close, yeah.
Another person who's been very, very close to you, and I know it's written about in the book, is Charlie Francis, of course, your longtime coach.
Charlie Francis was a father to me, and he's a wonderful man. I mean, if you know him very well, whatever happened, Charlie didn't even do anything wrong. We're just doing what anybody else was doing, a level playing field. And because we do it better than everybody else and win the world record in a 9.79, shutting down at 90 meters and with my hands up in the air, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, we all remember it well. Tell me about Charlie comes to see you, I believe, a few days later, and he's the bearer of bad news. I would suspect he was the logical person to come tell you, but how do you remember that moment?
About 7:30 in the morning, he knocked on my door, and he was so serious, like someone died. And I said, what's wrong? He goes, you test positive. And I said, no way. He said, yeah. And I sit down on the couch and put my head in my palm of my hand and say, they finally got me.
And yet, you know, I mean, we all know in retrospect what that race was like, but did you ever worry that, I mean, everybody knew that what you were doing was against the rules, right? I mean, whether someone got caught or not, did you ever fear that using performance-enhancing drugs would one day, I mean, any one of you could have been caught, but it was you. You won, right?
The rules is for everybody in sports, in track and field. You know, it's a level playing field. We know that everybody was doing it, and because I do it better, win a gold medal, set a world record, I got a lot of jealous people. And if I'm going to test positive, I want to test positive for the drug I use, not the drugs I didn't use. And that was a misery up until today. How you got in my system? I know that I was going to win a race. I know that I was going to get test positive. I mean, be tested. And why I want to go and do something a few days before the race or even the day before the race, and it doesn't work like that.
Yeah. I think a lot of people who aren't athletes, Ben, and especially back then, because people didn't know much about that. We know a lot more now. We knew a lot more 10 years later. That people were just really disappointed, right? People really were just upset. Yeah.
People was upset. And the reason why people were upset, because Canada never ready for my accomplishment. It was new to them that sports wasn't very big in Canada back then. I mean, you have the Blue Jays.
Track and field, right? Yeah, track and field wasn't. Yeah.
You have the Blue Jays, you have the Argonauts, and there wasn't really anything. There wasn't really any championship or any of the World Series or anything like that. But track and field was very big, and who never know about track and field, watch track and field back then. And I was all in the media and setting world records everywhere and racing every other continent everywhere. So it was pretty big at that time.
What was it like to come back? Because I remember when you came back, and I can't imagine what it would like to
When I came back, I was planning on going to Jamaica and just to ease out. And then my mom said, no, let's stay here and fight this thing and get a lawyer and get everything done. But the Dublin inquiry and those things was just for me to incriminate myself. And that was the bad situation that happened to me back then. You know, it's when I win the gold medal and the news hit, my dad say, Canada, I have to defend my son. That never happened, right? So I left alone and fight this thing by myself with a new team was on board. Didn't know anything about sports, don't know anything about track and field. And I have these people representing me and jumping on the bus. Everybody gang up on me, trying to make a name for themselves, trying to make money. And then I'm the guy who left out in the cold. That's not right. And those kind of things bothers me up until this day.
Ben Johnson is with us this half hour. We are talking about a new book that's out that revisits Ben Johnson's story, especially of the 1988 Olympics, both the gold medal and the disqualification and all that happened afterwards. Ben, as you well know, because I'm sure you've paid attention to how this has been told, I think there was an expectation after you admitted to using performance-enhancing drugs. And keep in mind, at a time when people didn't know much about how this all worked, right? I think we're far more knowledgeable now. But people might have just said, you know, you cheated, you got caught, and that was the end of the story. But you don't feel that's the end of the story, right? And tell me a bit about what's happened in the years since.
I use performance-enhancing drugs for my training, so I can train and recovery and do what I need to do. All those guys was also using performance-enhancing drugs. Why am I so different? The problem is, I'm not going to take the blame to be a poster boy for steroids where the rest of the world is doing the same thing.
Right.
No, I'm not going to sit down and do that. I'm still alive. I'm going to fight what I believe in. I'm going to fight what is right. I didn't get due process. I didn't get my hearing. I didn't have a time to present my case. You know, Dick Pound was also the IOC members and also on the Canadian Federation, Canadian Olympic Association. And, you know, you wanted to defend me as an athlete or you want to also defend the system. And you can't have it both ways. And that's what really happened with the politics play in this area. It was a very, very nasty game. And there's not much I can do about it. It happened. You know, it's been 36 years. You know, I want people and the public to know what the truth was and what really went down. I'm a human being. I got feelings. I got my rights. And I know I'm coming back here 36 years later and people are saying that, oh, we know the story. No, you don't know the story. This is a story. And this is what really happened. And this is what really went down.
Right. Did you continue watching sprinting after Donovan Bailey won in 1996? I saw Usain Bolt in London. He was an amazing sprinter. Did you continue to watch? Could you still watch?
I watched some of those races. And if I was still running, even if I was running so much years later, I could have beat those guys. I mean, not Usain Bolt because I was too long older then. But I'm saying is in my prime, on a fast track, new technology, better shoes, what they're wearing now, I can beat everybody. They can't beat Ben Johnson. And they know that. And all those things that they're doing right now, running fast, we are the one who make these guys running fast. Charlie Francis and Ben Johnson. They didn't know about the sprinting performance and also the peak performance, the peak time to run fast on that given day. They all learn from us. And they think that they are the one who invent this. They didn't invent nothing. Ben Johnson and Charlie Francis is the blueprint of track and field. We are the game changer of this game.
If you could go back, is there one thing, is there anything you would change?
Well, I wouldn't run for this country if I'm going to treat it this way. I tell you that much.
Yeah, you would have run.
I run for my Jamaican, my people, and my country, if that was the case.
You were made to feel un-Canadian.
That's right. That's right. Not the way I was treated. You know, people don't understand how much I train or how hard I train for how many years. You know, I trained for 13 years, 14 years. I never missed one practice, my friend. Not even one practice. That's incredible. A lot of people don't know this.
Well, I don't think anyone ever doubted you were fantastic. I don't think anyone ever doubted that. I mean, no one ever did. So for those who think they know your story, and of course, some of the things, obviously, you'll understand that some of the arguments you put forward will never be proven, right? They just won't. We'll never know exactly what happened in 1988, I don't think.
But, I know what happened. It happened to me. So I fight what I believe in. Fair is fair. I believe in fairness. I don't believe in hearsay and I say and she say. I believe in facts. And the facts is there.
Ben, I appreciate your time. You know, the fact that we're talking about this again 36 years later is certainly interesting. And I appreciate you sharing your story with me.
Yes, thank you.
I hope it is an inspiration to like-minded people to step up and pitch in, to get involved in the public life of this country, and to know that a positive, optimistic, hopeful vision of public life isn't a naive dream. It can be a powerful force for change.
Ah, there you have it. October 19th, 2015. New leaders always sound so optimistic, don't they? And, you know, of course, Justin Trudeau sounded even more optimistic than most when he was elected. You know, there he was, a new face, but a very familiar name on Canada's political scene. Not necessarily that new a face, but to some extent, he'd kind of come out of third place to win that election. And he basically steamrolled to victory over Stephen Harper, who'd been in power for the better part of a decade at that point, as well as Thomas Mulcair and the NDP, who were actually at one point the odds-on favorites to unseat Stephen Harper at the time. 4 years after the Liberals showed what was their worst election result since Confederation, they were back in power. And not only were they back in power, they were there with a very familiar and very comforting name and presence, a Trudeau as prime minister. That time and that message of inclusivity and hope may seem a bit quaint to some, a bit dated to others, and downright infuriating to a growing number of Canadians these days, according to the polls at least. And now nearly 8.5 years later, the Liberals are indeed struggling in the polls, trailing the Conservatives and Pierre Poilievre by about 20 points. If you look at most polling these days, it's not done yet. We'll see how those translate into votes. But perhaps it is time to have a good look at what's been going on with Justin Trudeau since he ascended to power and before. So one of Canada's most astute political observers and writers is actually turning his attention to that very story. Paul Wells's new book is called Trudeau on the Ropes, Governing in Troubled Times. And it is a look back at his rise to power, his 2015 majority, and his 8.5 years in office since. Now, Wells makes a really crucial point. In politics, it is hard to argue with success. And Justin Trudeau, love him or hate him, has won 3 straight elections over a Conservative Party that was eager to dismiss him as a lightweight from the get-go. And yet he defeated Stephen Harper, Andrew Scheer, Aaron O'Toole, not to mention Thomas Mulcair and Jagmeet Singh. But Trudeau finds himself in a pretty different situation right now, a pretty different fight. Part of his recent fall is self-inflicted. Part of it is due to circumstances. And there is that grim truth that while a week in politics may seem like an eternity, 9 years as prime minister really is a very long time in politics. So what does his past tell us about his present and possibly about his future? As I mentioned, Paul Wells' latest book is called Trudeau on the Ropes, Governing in Troubled Times. You can find Paul's regular columns these days on his Substack page at paulwells.substack.com. But before you go do that, we welcome Paul Wells to the show. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Timing is really interesting because I think there has been this, you know, I mean, if you take this long view as you always do, and this feels like the right time to talk about a long view of Justin Trudeau. But I mean, it's interesting that you begin with sort of looking in some ways at his successes, because if we think back 10 years ago, it felt like the Liberal Party might be done, or at least not in a position to win an election anytime soon. And he pulled that off.
Yeah. So where I begin is with the notion that you can't understand Trudeau's rise without understanding the terrible decade that the Liberal Party had before he became a candidate to lead it. Three of the four worst election defeats in the history of the party were Paul Martin 2006, Stefan Dion 2008, yeah, and then Michael Ignatieff of 2011. I mean, and each one worse than the previous one. And I mean, the party was essentially dead by 2011, so much so that Peter C. Newman wrote a book-length obituary called When the Gods Changed, which was about the end of modern liberalism. So first of all, kudos to Trudeau for reversing that trend. Secondly, it meant that when he got to power, he had one of the most inexperienced governments that anyone's ever had, because all of the institutional memory of the Liberal Party had lost or walked away by then. And that conditions a lot of what comes after.
And in some, what I've heard too, is that in many ways, he didn't really reach out to that previous generation of liberals, you know, sort of the Chrétien cabinet ministers of the world. They were kind of in their own little bubble when they came to power.
Yeah, he saw the Liberal Party as a vehicle and a handy conceptual handle for people to put on him, but he didn't feel beholden to previous generations of liberals. And he mostly thought they were more trouble than they were worth, people were sick of liberals and not sick of Justin Trudeau. And so that's why they called it Team Trudeau. That's why older generations of candidates who were too closely associated with the Chrétien Martin wars weren't welcome, and why he had no hesitation about kicking every liberal senator out of his caucus. I mean, these were people who'd given their lives to the party. But to him, it was a different party. They'd given lives to the old Liberal Party that he wanted to forget as soon as he could.
Which seems at this, you know, with hindsight, an awful lot of hubris for someone who didn't really have, and I went to university with Justin Trudeau, he didn't really have much in the way of what one would call sort of great strategic chops, right, to reinvent the most storied party in Canadian political history in his own image.
Although, as I say in the book, I tend to give people who win the benefit of the doubt. Once is a fluke, but twice starts to suggest you've got something on the ball. He has won three elections in a row, two of them with the narrowest victories imaginable, but he still has found ways to reinvent himself to win. And on some of the big challenges that he's faced, the election of Donald Trump, which was a existential threat to the Canada-US relationship, and the early response to COVID, I think he's got some good stories to tell. Look, this book is critical of Justin Trudeau, but I don't have it in me to just slag somebody from one end to the other. And I hope that this book recognizes some of the things that he's handled well or that he hasn't screwed up.
Yeah, you have an interesting quote in there that says he gets the big things right and just about everything else wrong, right? Which is interesting. I mean, again, I don't think a lot of Canadians were very supportive of Justin Trudeau when he came in to replace what felt like a very tired Stephen Harper government. I mean, it's inevitable in politics that people get sick of watching, what was it, John Manley talked about, the Seinfeld effect, right? Nine seasons, and people start to get a bit tired of hearing the same show. But governments often wind up being their own worst enemies in some ways. And I think you really dig into that in this book about his managerial style, his you know, his sort of my way or the highway approach to it has not helped him in the long run.
I think a lot of people inside the government were surprised at how hard it was to disagree with this government from inside, how hard it was to have a different angle on things. And there's been a steady exodus of people who thought they were valued parts of the team, either in crisis, like Jane Philpott, Jody Wilson-Raybould, even in sort of more nuanced, complex situations like Bill Morneau, who was essentially fired from cabinet. Neither of them liked that choice of term, but that's essentially what happened. But even a guy like Mark Garneau, who hadn't heard a fly, has schools named after him, is a sort of a Canadian culture hero, and had just run for re-election, had just signed himself up for another term in parliament before getting kicked out of cabinet, and he had no indication that was coming. Trudeau's definition of liberalism has no room for people who are sure they're not liberal. Obviously, like, this government is more and more suspicious of people who aren't their natural allies. But it also is surprisingly inhospitable to a lot of people who thought they were liberal all along.
And what is at the root of that? Because, I mean, Trudeau came in with obviously the name and the pedigree of his father, and also this idea that maybe he could rebuild the Liberal Party into something that would be lasting again. I mean, I think that was the hope amongst liberals. And yet here we are 10 years later. There's a poll out today about potential successors. It doesn't feel like there is one necessarily. You wonder if this is just if he managed to rebuild the party in his own image. And then you think, well, what next?
I don't know what the Liberals' long-term prospects are. But I think this narrowness, I think a lot of the decisions he's made, one of the sort of working assumptions I had for this book was that there's a reasonable explanation for most of what he's done, or you know, there's a context within which you can understand, and you can even imagine that another leader would have done the same thing. Mm-hmm. So they tighten control because they've got a caucus full of rookies. They tighten control because they overpromised on their way into office in 2015, and they had an agenda that they simply by the number of hours in a day, they were going to have terrible difficulty implementing. And so they didn't have a lot of time for debate and rumination because they had overstacked their policy agenda. And then at just about the time you'd think he might start relaxing as prime minister and as party leader, the world starts to go a little sideways. Donald Trump, Brexit, a more belligerent China, eventually COVID, are contexts within which it's not super easy to relax, right? And so he, eventually every leader prizes loyalty over intelligence. They prize loyalty over anything else, over competence, because loyalty is the one thing you have to be able to rely on. And he used to think he would have the luxury of not demanding loyalty, but the world started to get a little hairy, and so finally he imposed loyalty tests first on his own people and lately on the rest of us.
You covered the Harper government extensively. Yep. Do you see parallels between, other than the time it's taken for them to fall out of favor, do you see parallels there in terms of this idea of control, of coming in with kind of wanting to chart a new course with a relatively inexperienced group of people around them, some very trusted insiders that had some previous experience, almost all of them in Ontario, oddly enough. But do you see parallels between the two in terms of how things have shaken down, all the circumstances being quite different? Although Harper had the financial crisis, Trudeau had Trump and the pandemic. I mean, you know, reality always gets in the way of the best laid plans for all politicians.
Yeah, I mean, I do see similarities, but both conservatives and liberals hate when you suggest a parallel between them. Right. So what I'll say more is that there are universal aspects. Like, it's really hard to find a government that over time has felt that it had the luxury to be an open talking shop. I mean, when Stephen Harper was introducing these message control methods and habits in 2008, 9, 10, 11, our colleagues in the White House Correspondents' Gallery in Washington were making similar complaints about the Obama presidency.
Right.
That he didn't speak to accredited reporters often enough, that you know, they would go around reporters by talking to you know, people on social media who were more congenial and stuff like that. That sort of message control stuff that we thought was because Harper was a mean SOB. At the same time, a lot of reporters in Washington, because it's simply how you respond to the crazy information overload of the social media age. And so if Trudeau does things that happen to be what similar to what Harper did, I mean, there's a temperamental thing. On most days, Trudeau is simply a more good tempered guy than Harper, although everyone can think of exceptions. But directionally, it's very similar. And it's not because one of them is imitating the other, or it's not a moral judgment. It's just, it's really hard to organize a large organization without paying some attention to message discipline and stuff like that.
Paul Wells, author and journalist. His latest is called Trudeau on the Ropes. We're talking about the book this half hour. Paul, interesting when we look, I guess, at 2024 now. And there's been a lot of focus. The excerpts of the book that have been published often focus on the sort of the polarization that we're seeing, effective polarization, as you call it, and how we now find ourselves in a situation where you have a leader of the Conservative Party who is clearly a good foe for Justin Trudeau, and how they both sort of find themselves quite far apart of these separate camps. But it's the ability of people to get sick of listening to the Trudeau message that seems to be driving people towards Pierre Poilievre. And it's been interesting to watch young people who may have only known, who may have taken Justin Trudeau's promises of change quite seriously back in 2015 and look up now 9 years later and think, well, I don't know how much of that has actually been promised. I'm interested in your take on that, because it's, the youth vote is what's really interested me in here and how it shifted from the Liberals so quickly in less than a decade.
Yeah. So one of the questions I struggle with, not really overtly in so many words in the book, but just in my own head, is it realistic to expect any prime minister's career to last much longer than a decade? Like maybe right. if Trudeau had done everything that I think he should have done, maybe he still would be burned out by now. And that's an unanswerable question. One thing I learned a long time ago is that the person who ends up defeating an incumbent government often looks like not just their worst fear, but like their like something they can't imagine succeeding. Like you end up being endangered and sometimes defeated by someone you think is a pure fool, right? Or a monster, right? So Paul Martin, people around Paul Martin, not necessarily Mr. Martin himself, were convinced that once Canadians got a good look at Stephen Harper, they would reject him. And the Harper Conservatives were absolutely convinced that Canadians would or could be made to laugh Justin Trudeau out of court. I had one Harper cabinet minister once called to me in private, called Trudeau objectively the stupidest major party leader in the last half century, right?
I think I've heard
well,
that.
But then he handed Harper his teeth. Like, I mean, yeah. And similarly, on some days, Pierre Poilievre looks like the ridiculous caricature of conservatism that Liberals have been depicting every conservative as for the last decade. Like, they ran against Erin O'Toole, who seemed like the second coming of Joe Clark, and they called him a monster and an extremist and so on and so on. Well, congratulations. Now you get your extremist. Like, that's just often the way of the world. But that's one of the things that makes it Trudeau likelier to stick around for a next election than to leave, because he can't imagine clearing the field rather than going into the battle against someone like Poilievre. Yeah. Honestly, I kind of wish they could both sneak off somewhere and have a coffee. I think they would both be surprised at what they would learn about each other. But lately, that's not the world that we're in.
No. And in that sense, we go back to the title of the book and sort of where it all begins with that infamous charity fight between Justin Trudeau and Patrick Brazeau back in 2012. And it's astounding that we still talk about it, but it seems to create such a good narrative arc for the Trudeau political career. You think that he's not going to walk away. He considers himself, he sees himself in that underdog, scrappy, rope-a-dope fighter, that he'll stick around to fight this one, even though it looks like he may lose, because expectations are if he loses, well, he loses. And if he wins, well, he's proven everyone wrong yet again.
Yeah, and I don't think any decision he makes on that front can be definitive. Like, I think the question will still be in the air until the day he goes to Rideau Hall to start another election, or the day he does walk away. I mean, you know, but if my strong suspicion is that right now, today, in May of 24, he expects to lead the Liberals into the next election. And that if he ever does leave before an election, I suspect, no one gives me their secrets. I suspect that it will be sometime after now that he changes his mind. And certainly at Christmas, in the year-end interviews he gave at Christmas, including to Terry DeMonte and a bunch of other people, he didn't sound like somebody who had any room in his universe for giving up. And honestly, if you're the Liberal Party of Canada, you want Justin Trudeau to lead the party into the next election. Rather than getting rid of him and then burning a new leader on a likely defeat. And also, longtime leaders tend to bring their parties in for softer landing than new leaders. So Stephen Harper, Conservatives didn't lose that badly when Stephen Harper led them in his last campaign. Jean Charest in Quebec in 2012, the party seemed like it was headed for just a complete flame out, but Charest didn't do too badly, and so on and so on. I think that's part of Trudeau's thinking. But I don't think if he runs again, I don't think he's going to run to lose. I think he's going to run to win, and we'll see.
Paul, thank you as always.
Thanks for having me.
We are following our allies like Australia and the United Kingdom, who have recently amended and strengthened their own foreign interference laws to deal with the threats that we all face today.
That is Justice Minister Arif Virani today, as the federal government announced that it has introduced legislation to fight foreign interference by creating new criminal offenses, allowing broader sharing of sensitive information. Public Safety Minister Dominic LeBlanc says he hopes to have the legislation in place before the next election, scheduled for October of 2025.
We're in a minority parliament. We're going to work with opposition parties. I'm hoping that the effort around this legislation, the opposition parties have been calling for many months for a foreign influence transparency registry.
Indeed, the registry would require some individuals to register their presence in the country with the federal government. And again, the opposition has been calling for it for a mighty long time. Now, it comes after last Friday's preliminary report from the Inquiry on Foreign Interference into the 2019 and 2021 federal elections found that while meddling from foreign powers, specifically China, but not uniquely China, did not affect the overall outcome of either election, but that it was present and it was a, quote, stain on our democratic processes. And on the heels of the arrests of three men in connection with the assassination of a Sikh activist, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, in the Vancouver area last June, a murder that has been alleged, was carried out at the request of elements of India's spy agency. RCMP Assistant Commissioner David Tabool said Friday that there are several investigations happening related to the murder, including possible links to a government overseas.
I will underscore that today's announcements are not a complete account of the investigative work currently underway. There are separate and distinct investigations ongoing into these matters, certainly not limited to the involvement of the people arrested today, and these efforts include investigating connections to the government of India.
Indeed. Now, those suspects, by the way, were arrested in Edmonton, the three of them, not known to police. They were here in this country on student visas. They will appear in court in Surrey on Tuesday morning via video, apparently. So we'll might find out a little bit more about the case then. Over the weekend, of course, there has been reaction from India. India's Foreign Affairs Minister, Subramaniam Jaishankar, was asked over the weekend about these arrests, and he claims Canada is allowing Sikh people who want a separate country to voice violent rhetoric against India while suggesting that some are criminals.
We have been telling Canada, saying, look, these are wanted criminals from India. You have given them visas. They have come, many of them, in false documentation. And yet you allow them to live there. If you decide to import for political purposes people with very dubious, actually very negative background, there will be issues.
Yeah, that doesn't sound much like contrition, does it? India originally denied any involvement in the BC homicide case, but started insisting it does not have an official policy of having people assassinated abroad after a similar case emerged in the U.S. And the U.S. is where we find Michael Kugelman, who's director of the South Asia Institute at the Wilson Center. Michael, welcome back. Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here with you.
Perhaps just your reaction to the arrests on Friday, because, of course, the case in the U.S. had gotten a lot of publicity. I think the Washington Post had a whole article out about it a few weeks ago, but we hadn't heard much in the way of developments in the murder case of Mr. Nijjar. And then suddenly on Friday, we have three arrests.
Right. Not too much of a surprise in the sense that Canadian law enforcement officials had been suggesting for some time that that arrests could be coming, but I think that quite frankly this really muddles the waters even more, in the sense that for many, and certainly for those in New Delhi, there has not been much evidence provided linking the Indian government to this assassination. And indeed, we've had these arrests of these three young men the other day. And yet, at least to this point, we have not heard publicly any indications or evidence linking these three men to the Indian government. There could be more to come, for sure. And as you said, these men are expected to make a court appearance on Tuesday. So maybe we'll be getting more information tomorrow or in the coming days. But I think that this just complicates things even more than they already were over the last few months.
Right, because in the American case, there had been, in fact, an approach of someone to be hired to commit an attack, I gather, who ended up being an undercover agent. So a lot of the case came out quite quickly. We actually understood a lot of the elements of that case quite quickly. In Canada, you're right, we have very little information of what, if any, link there is between these three men who've been arrested and the Indian government.
Right, exactly. And, you know, this is one of the big contrasts between the two cases, you know, the assassination in Canada and the attempted assassination in the U.S. And indeed, you had this indictment from in New York that was unsealed last year, and it was full of details, right? I mean, it was a very long indictment. There was all kinds of information, all kinds of details about the assassination attempt, and also laying out in a lot of detail allegations of Indian involvement. And we now know with through a recent Washington Post article that there are even more detailed allegations that have even identified a specific individual, allegedly an Indian intelligence officer who was leading this assassination plot in the U.S. In contrast, in Canada, there really has not been much of that at all. And I think that, and we may have talked about this previously, that's one reason that explains why the Indian reaction to the Canadian allegations has been so different than its from its reaction to the U.S. allegations. It's very difficult, I think, for India to just angrily deny the U.S. allegations when you have such details, such large amounts of details laid out in that unsealed indictment. We haven't had anything like that in Canada, at least not yet.
Yeah, and perhaps that may explain the reaction from India's foreign affairs minister, Jai Shankar, over the weekend, where he basically reiterates what India has been saying all along, that Canada is harboring sort of dangerous elements, and you know, you reap what you sow.
Right, exactly. Of course, you know, we have to look at this in a broader context, in the sense that the Indian relationship with Canada has been much more fragile and troubled and tense than the Indian relationship with the U.S. I think that's another reason why we have this very defiant, angry, very undiplomatic public reaction from very senior Indian officials, including Jai Shankar. There's also the fact that from the Indian perspective, you've had for quite some time the Canadian government, and including the current prime minister in Canada, who have been openly associating themselves with those that align themselves with Sikh separatism. This is an allegation that India's government has made for quite some time. So this is obviously something that damaged the relationship between India and Canada, but I think it also explains why we have such angry reactions from the Indian side. And again, very different from what you hear from the Indian side vis-a-vis the U.S. allegations.
Yeah, I mean, part of that one always thinks is that you know, Delhi has more respect, or at least worries slightly more about offending Washington than it does Ottawa, that it feels like this could be, I mean, because so much of this, it feels like, is for domestic consumption, right? I mean, this is really, there are so many layers to this, but it feels like mainly for domestic consumption, because really, I mean, it seems to me the threat of sort of Khalistani separatism is probably pretty negligible in India right now. And the groups that are espouse it here, I mean, there was reports out over the weekend that, you know, the Indian government had repeatedly gone to Canada to try to get Nijjar arrested and sent back. And there just never was any credible evidence as far as the Canadians were concerned.
Right. And as you say, this is exactly true. This Khalistan movement is not completely dead, but it's pretty close to it, in a sense that it does not really exist in a notable way in India. And indeed, you do have some small pockets of support for it in Canada, as well as in the U.S. and some other countries, Australia and U.K., among others. But, you know, these are some folks that are, you know, hundreds of miles away from India. But that said, and this is another reason why you have these tensions in the India-Canada relationship, I think from India's perspective, there's an unwillingness on the part of Canada to acknowledge just how serious of a threat this used to be and how serious of a threat it is becoming again, according to the Indian side. I mean, the Khalistan movement was something that was manifested as a visible insurgency for a long period of time in the 80s into the early 1990s, which led to significant numbers of deaths, terrorist attacks, and so on. And the Indian view, at least the Indian view that's put out there publicly, is that you're starting to see this movement return through a number of dangerous characters abroad. But absolutely right, the domestic political context in India is critical, in the sense that right now, as we speak, as you know, India is going through an election, national elections, which began last month and will run through June 1st. So I think that there's something to be said for the Indian government to be essentially pushing back. And I think that the idea is to project this very nationalistic tone and say, well, how dare we be accused of doing something like this? This is something that the ruling party has, I think, done very well, playing on grievances among sizable numbers of the Indian public that Western governments, despite their good relations with India, are oftentimes quick to accuse India of things that it does not do. So absolutely, there are, I think, domestic political gains for the Indian government to respond in the way that it has.
Right. And I mean, I covered the Air India inquiry back about 20 years ago now, I think, but and had a classmate at the high school I ended up graduating from who had died on Air India. I think that attack still looms quite large in the relationship between the two countries.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, as I said, I mean, this is something that goes back for such a long time. And indeed, to this day, India, not just the current government, but previous Indian governments as well, have been very unhappy about how Canada handled that whole tragedy legally and so on. And it's absolutely a contributing factor to the tensions in the relationship now. I mean, not the only factor, but certainly one of the key ones. And I think it reflects this broader view in New Delhi and among many in India that Canada does not take these things as seriously as it should, particularly given that it is meant to be a close partner of India. And indeed, it has been a close partner. I mean, these are two countries that have had a pretty significant good relationship, despite all the things that have come up over the last few years. And I think India expects that Canada do more to show that it's mindful of these Indian concerns.
Michael Kugelman has been nice enough to be with us tonight from the States. He's director of the South Asia Institute at the Wilson Center. We've been talking about developments in Canada-India relations over the weekend. Their foreign ministers come out, and without much contrition about these arrests that we've seen, that we saw in Edmonton on Friday, three men will be charged tomorrow, or at least will appear in court tomorrow via video in Surrey. They've been charged in connection with the murder of Sikh activist Hardeep Singh Nijjar last June in Surrey, BC. We don't know much more about them. They weren't known to police. They were international students from India of Sikh origin here on student visas. We don't think they went to school. Other than that, we don't know much about them. And there hasn't been much new information out over the weekend, except for the Indian foreign minister essentially saying Canada attracts bad people or lets bad people into the country for political reasons and you reap what you sow. So no signs of a detente in that relationship just yet. Michael, I think Canada finds itself in a pretty tough situation because I think it is, you know, we're beholden at a certain point to recognize a growing and more powerful India's concerns if we want to be friends and be good trading partners with India. At the same time, if a country is as are the allegations say, are carrying out sort of extraterritorial assassinations of their political enemies, we don't know that to be true, or at least attempts, which the American case would suggest, that's a red line. So I guess diplomatically, that puts Canada in a pretty tough spot right now, and the Americans.
Yeah, absolutely true. And I think if you look at the few details we know about these three men that were arrested, you know, as you noted, they came on student visas, but it's not clear they went to school at all. Yeah, I think that one of the strengths of the Canada-India relationship in recent years has been the people-to-people aspects of the relationship. You've got significant, very large numbers of Indian students coming to Canada over the years. I think that you've got more Indian students in Canada than in most other countries. So that suggests that the broader trajectory of the relationship could be impacted negatively by this case. And also, you know, we've been hearing very tough messaging from the Indian government. I think it was just a few months ago when the Indian High Commissioner in Canada, in an interview with the Canadian press, said that basically India will not cooperate in an investigation until it receives evidence from Canada suggesting its role. So, yeah, I think unlike the case with the U.S. and India, where the strategic components of partnership could, I think, provide insulation from tensions around the extrajudicial killing issue, you don't have that in the case of Canada and India, just because the assassination has become such a huge crisis for the relationship. It'll be really difficult to get out of that. But it is unfortunate because, you know, you talk about India and its economic clout. We've seen in recent years, despite tensions in Canada-India relations, bilateral trade volume has surged a significant amount. But you know, I think that could be impacted, particularly if people to people ties are impacted. And even on the U.S. India side, you know, I'll say this: even though that relationship is very strong, you know, it's very strong imperative or strong rationale from Washington's perspective for continuing to work with India to counter China, you know, U.S. officials are concerned, and particularly those that engage in the more sensitive forms of diplomacy with India, those that deal with intelligence sharing, tech transfers. You know, they can't help but be concerned about, you know, who they're doing business with, right? Who they're sharing information with, a country that, you know, may well have attempted an extrajudicial killing on U.S. soil. So even for this relationship between the U.S. and India, which is stronger than the Canada-India relationship, even there's some concerns. And I think on the Canada-India side, they're going to be even stronger just because, you know, the relationship on the whole is much more fragile and vulnerable.
Do you get the sense, I mean, we'll know, I guess, in early June whether Modi has won. Presumably he's about to win. It seems like he's destined to win another term, a third term. Could that offer an opportunity for detente? I mean, you know, the lead up to elections themselves often see leaders become, you know, harden their positions on things such as this, where they just can't look weak in a position. He can't look weak on this file right now. Do you think if he wins again come early June, there may be an opportunity for some sort of detente? Maybe not publicly, but at least back channels?
I don't expect so. I mean, indeed, Modi will likely win a third term. And if he does, I think that one of the big focus areas of his administration will be on legacy building, because he could try for a fourth term if he wanted to, but I anticipate he will not. So I think that suggests, if he's going to be focusing on legacy building, he's going to want to be consolidating his successes and his achievements. And from his perspective and the BJP's perspective, that entails showing strength, both at home and abroad. And I think that that would entail India continuing to take a very defiant, tough line on this issue with Canada. I don't see Modi being willing, even privately, to take a softer position, being willing to cooperate more with Canada on the investigation and so on and so forth. Honestly, I would say this. I think that the election to be thinking about here is not the Indian one, but the Canadian one, the next Canadian election. It seems that the Modi government is just very unhappy with the Trudeau government, particularly with what India believes to be the current government or the current prime minister's desire to align himself with certain political constituencies in Canada that are sympathetic to Sikh separatism. Whether that's right or wrong, not my place to say, but it will be interesting to see how things change after the Canadian election, depending on the result, of course. But domestic politics are everything, of course,
they
and
are.
Foreign policy included. So I think that we need to be thinking about the implications from both countries' elections.
Yeah, all politics is local. I mean, for the next government, I suppose, if you had any advice, because one of the issues here has been, you know, a lot of, and I think we've seen this in other places, but Canada has been particularly guilty of it in some ways, is that they've reduced all foreign problems to diaspora politics internally, right? We saw that we had a foreign interference inquiry release its first report last week talking about this very issue, and that it has blinded Canadian politicians sometimes to how it's perceived in other places. So we consider, you know, and rightly so to some extent, the freedom of expression and the freedom of speech within a country such as Canada to express your opinions about politics back home, say in India, and you know, to call for a separate Sikh state, for instance. You know, there's nothing illegal about that in Canada. But in some ways, I don't know whether we recognized how sensitive that issue was to others in how it's built up over the years. And perhaps a new leader might help if they were to get off on the good foot. But it's a very difficult balance for a country like Canada when dealing with a growing power like India, because sometimes its concerns fly in the face of what are protected rights in this country.
Yeah, absolutely right. And indeed, this is, again, another reason why you have this tension in this relationship, and to a degree in India's relations with the U.S. and the other countries where you have these very small but active manifestations of Sikh separatist sentiment that, you know, in these countries, and these are all very strong democracies, you know, there is very strong support for this type of speech. Even if, from India's perspective, it's tantamount to support for terrorism. You know, again, I emphasize this, you know, from the position in New Delhi is that, you know, the guy that was killed, Najjar, and the guy that was almost killed, Panoon in the U.S., you know, they are viewed in New Delhi as bin Laden-like characters. You know, that is how they project them, as terrorists who absolutely should not be free and should not be receiving any type of soft support or any type of support or tolerance from the government in the countries where they're living. But yeah, this is a problem because, you know, Canada and the U.S. and other countries like this, I mean, it's so important to protect these rights in this speech, so long as it doesn't lead to violence. And we have had a few cases of small groups of Khalistan supporters staging small but notable violence acts outside or near Indian consulates. This happened in San Francisco several times last year. And the U.S. government very quickly condemned that, and I believe they launched an investigation to deal with those behind that. But speech itself, even if it's expressing support for Khalistan, for a separate Sikh state, indeed, this is not illegal in Canada. It's not illegal in the United States. But India just sees things very differently. And that's one reason why we're where we're at now with the very troubled state of relations between Canada and India.
Well, to be continued. Michael, as always, thanks for your insight on this.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
There was a big development in an ongoing case in Winnipeg that you may remember. The trial of a man accused of killing four women in that city will now be heard by judge alone instead of jury. Jeremy Skibecki admitted to court in court that he killed the four women, but his lawyers are asking that he be found not criminally responsible because of mental illness. Skibecki has pleaded not guilty to four counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of Rebecca Côtois, Morgan Harris, Mercedes Myron, and an unidentified woman Indigenous leaders have named Buffalo Woman.
I don't even have any words. It was just kind of a shock. We're so happy. Our whole family will be so happy to hear this.
That is Morgan Harris's cousin, Melissa Robinson, there. She says the family approves of the decision to have a judge alone preside over this case.
Convincing 12 versus our judge. Either way, we were pretty confident. You know, we've sat down many times with the Crowns. They explained everything to us ahead of time. So either way, we were confident, but, you know, even more happier now that it's judge alone.
Now, police initially arrested Skibecki about 2 years ago after the partial remains, later identified as Côtois, were found in a garbage bin near a Winnipeg apartment building. The following month, police recovered more of her remains from a landfill in the city. Police said their investigation then determined that three other women were killed between March and May of that same year of 2022. Joining me now is Brandon Trask. He's an assistant professor of law at the University of Manitoba, who's been following this case. Brandon, thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks, Ben.
For those who just kind of dip in and out of this when it makes headlines, I think this came as a bit of a surprise today that he had confessed to these killings.
Yeah, this is quite the development this morning. I personally was quite surprised to hear how this went, given sort of the lead up to this. But yeah, quite the development this morning. And then also very interesting to see that the Crown consented ultimately to a judge alone trial going forward, now that the trial is focused just on the issue of NCR, not criminally responsible.
And that is, I mean, maybe we can just walk through some of what happened today, because as you mentioned, there were a lot of developments. For the defense, it had sort of, I don't know if they'd hinted at this in the past, they had been trying to have a judge only trial for a bit, right?
Yeah, so they'd actually made sort of two separate applications for a judge alone trial. And so I think a lot of people in Canada don't realize that actually the default for a murder case is judge and jury. You know, I think a lot of people that I've heard speak about this, you know, just assume that an accused individual gets to choose whether they want a judge right. alone or a judge and jury trial. But no, in Canada, Parliament has set out that the default is judge and jury for a murder case. And, you know, typically the only pathway to a judge alone trial is if the Crown consents to that, along with, of course, the accused wanting that.
Right. I suppose that's from watching too much American TV, I would imagine. In this case, though, obviously the prosecution has to agree to it. So under what circumstances here would they, I mean, we heard from the family of one of the victims, obviously happy that this was about this development. I guess that might play a role in the prosecution's acceptance of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, and again, it's an important reminder, I think, for everybody as well. The Crown, certainly in Canada, is not out just for a conviction, right? The Crown has a higher duty than that to ensure that justice is done. So, you know, the individual Crown attorneys act as sort of quasi-ministers of justice to make sure that, you know, they don't lose sight of the bigger picture here, which is the pursuit of justice and, again, ensuring that fairness prevails at the end of the day as well. So, yeah, certainly taking into account a whole host of factors in deciding whether to give consent to this request or not. Just personally observing this, I think it was a very sensible decision to ultimately agree to giving consent to the judge alone trial going forward. NCR focused trials are very, very complicated. They can be quite time consuming and again, very technical. So I think, you know, a judge alone trial going forward makes sense for all sides now that there was that admission essentially that Mr. Skibicki was involved in the deaths of these four individuals. So that aspect no longer needs to be addressed. The focus here is on whether Mr. Skibicki is not criminally responsible going forward.
Yeah, perhaps, Brendan, walk us through a bit about how challenging that can be. I mean, what would the defense have to prove here? Because I gather these killings happened over a fairly extended period of time, and that strikes me as being something that might be hard to prove, that someone was not criminally responsible through that, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think this is going to be a real challenge for defense to establish. And so because defense, Mr. Skibicki is the one claiming NCR here, that means the onus is on the defense to prove on a balance of probabilities that he was suffering from a disease of the mind at the time of the offenses, and also that this disease of the mind made him incapable of either appreciating the nature and quality of the act or of knowing that the act was wrong. So there are sort of two pathways to a potential NCR verdict. Those are very, very challenging, I think, for the defense to establish in these circumstances where it wasn't, sort of a single moment in time. You've got, you know, four killings presumably a much longer stretch of time than you would see in a typical attempted NCR case.
Right. And I guess that's what the prosecution will attempt to sort of poke holes at.
Yeah, exactly. And so because the onus is on the defense here, again, to show this on a balance of probabilities that he was NCR, the role of the Crown is largely to poke holes, as you said, and essentially refute the evidence being put forward by the defense to make that claim. So, you know, going forward, I suspect we'll hear from, at least a few experts, possibly more than just a few experts from both sides. The Crown no doubt will try to build a case poking holes in what the defense puts forward. Just as an observer here, it's going to be quite the challenge for defense to overcome the length of time that is in play in this particular case to show that, you know, the NCR special verdict should apply across all four killings across quite a period of time. That's going to be, I think, a real, real struggle for the defense.
Did the circumstances that unfolded today, I don't want to use the word easier, but does it make any difference for the families of the victims? Because again, we heard from one of the family members of one of the victims today saying that they were happy with the judge only trial, that in some senses, the fact that he has admitted guilt already, and now we're going to have a judge only trial based on this, you know, this defense, that in some sense brought some sense of relief to them.
I mean, just speculating, I would think that, you know, this development likely will bring at least some form of closure, knowing, hey, this is Mr. Skibicki, saying that he was involved with the killing of these four individuals. So, that puts an end to at least that part of the question, right? And so going forward, everybody knows Mr. Skibicki was involved in the killing of these four individuals. Now it's simply a question of, should he be found guilty or should he be found NCR in relation to these killings? But at least, the families of the four individuals and frankly, everybody in society knows that this was Mr. Skibicki that played the role in these killings.
Brendan Trask is nice enough to be with us this half hour. He's an assistant professor of law at the University of Manitoba. We're talking about a big development in the murders of four women in Winnipeg a few years back. Now, Jeremy Skibicki, who was the suspect in those cases, today admitted to court that he'd killed them. His lawyers are asking that he be found not criminally responsible because of mental illness. We discussed all the why that would be, how it unfolds from here, and how difficult it will be for the defense to prove that. Brendan, when you look at this, the impact this case has had on Winnipeg, and sometimes big stories out of Winnipeg don't find their way into places like Vancouver and Toronto, but I get the impression this has just been a really devastating case for the city, and the tensions have been really high around it, and so a lot of people are watching closely, and this makes this development all the more pronounced today.
Yeah, absolutely, and this case, I think very unfortunately, ended up having a role that was played in our most recent provincial election as well. Mm-hmm. With the at the time the governing Progressive Conservative Party running big ads, billboards in the city, essentially being opposed to searching the landfill where the remains are thought to be for the victims of Mr. Skibicki. Right. So like I said, the political implications, along with, of course, the legal implications, which we've been discussing, are massive. And I think absolutely you've identified the tensions that exist, and those permeate a number of different aspects of what we've seen play out, certainly politically in and around Manitoba for the past several months.
I read back, of course, that in March, both Winnipeg and Ottawa had pledged $20 million to go towards the search of the landfill, where it's believed the remains of two of the victims are. Is that proceeding?
So it very much still sort of a work in progress as far as we've members of the public have been informed, and there was some discussion earlier several months ago that it was suggested that actually a search of the landfill could cause complications with regard to the trial of Mr. Skibicki. Right. I think any of those concerns are now put to rest with the developments from this morning. An ongoing search could cause delays was one of the concerns that was raised. Could cause delays with regard to the trial, and that could lead to what's called a Jordan application. Saying that this trial is taking an unreasonable amount of time. With the risk that, a remedy could be essentially that there's a judicial stay of proceedings, putting an end to the whole trial. But again, I think with the developments this morning, all of that is no longer an issue. So any concerns that were identified about searching the landfill, causing repercussions as far as legal proceedings against Mr. Skibicki, I don't think those are legitimate concerns any longer.
And as for the trial itself, you mentioned it'll probably be a relatively complicated and lengthy one. When does this all begin?
Yeah, so Wednesday is apparently planned to be the next day when things will get moving. But realistically, I expect that this will take a number of twists and turns over the coming weeks. Could take longer than that, depending. Typically in a NCR focused case like this, you'd expect to see experts called from both sides. And of course, the expert opinions are not alone determinative. It's ultimately up to the judge now going forward to make the rulings at the end of the day, make the findings. Those findings will certainly be informed by listening to the experts. And so, You know, that's always an interesting aspect of these trials as well, because, again, probably watching too much American TV, I think a lot of people are under the impression that, well, you know, experts just essentially do the bidding of whatever side has retained them. That's actually not the case in Canada. Experts owe their primary duty to the court. They're there to help the court reach its determination. So, and again, but you can have experts come up with very different opinions on matters. So, yeah, I expect that we'll see defense, you know, call experts who, you know, who are suggesting that, yes, there are these indicators that Mr. Skibicki was NCR at the time.
Right.
But I expect, you know, similarly, we'll hear other opinions from the Crown.
Indeed. Well, Brandon, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Where's the most isolated place in Britain? So I went round. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of nothingness. Looked across the loch, saw this woodland. That's the place.
Loch Treig. It's known as the Lonely Loch. There's no road here. But they used to live here before they built the dam. And all their ruins are down there.
That is the voice of Ken Smith. The 76-year-old is the subject of a new book called The Way of the Hermit, My Incredible 40 Years Living in the Wilderness. His is a remarkable story, to say the very least. He was born in 1947 in a small village in northern England. He would follow in his father's footsteps and become a laborer, but a series of incidents would leave him looking for something and somewhere different. He had spent some time working in forestry in the Scottish Highlands, so nature and the freedom of the great outdoors is really what appealed to him. But it wasn't Britain where he would find out if and how he could survive off the grid. It was here in Canada on a trip to BC and the Yukon in 1979 with a good friend, followed by another one to BC, Alberta, Yukon, the Northwest Territories, and Alaska a few years later, returning to Britain in the mid-80s with no home, no money, but the confidence that he could, in fact, live off the grid and live by his own terms. Basically propelled him forward. He set out across the island, across all of Britain, looking for somewhere to settle down. And as you heard in that clip from a story that was done about him not long ago, he found it in a remote place called Loch Treig in the Highlands of Scotland that simply was ideal for him. It was there that he has lived for decades, off the grid, in a cabin, a Canadian-style cabin, he even mentions it in the book, that he built himself. As his legend grew in the area, inevitably so did interest in sharing his story. That happened first in a documentary and now in this book, co-written by BBC presenter and author Will Millard. Smith himself doesn't have access to the tools he would need to speak with me directly on this show, but Will Millard does, and he was kind enough to join us from England to share Ken's story and how he came to tell it. The book is called The Way of the Hermit, My Incredible 40 Years Living in the Wilderness, and Will Millard, the co-author, joins me now. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben. It's a real pleasure to be here.
What a fascinating read this is. I mean, Ken's story in of itself is amazing. Where did you come across it? Because I feel like it's a story that probably hasn't been off told.
Yeah. I mean, how do you find a hermit, right?
Right.
You're not going to go on Hermits or Us on Facebook or something like that.
Yeah. Swipe left for hermits. Yes. No, I know.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. I mean, as a writer, you're always on the lookout for good human stories. And I write a lot about incredible people that have spent their lives in the wild and living in the wilderness and close to nature. So, I mean, I've always sort of been tapped into that world and the various little places where you might be able to find the next story. And it just so happened that I was actually having a look at the shortlists for the Glasgow Film Festival up in Scotland, this independent documentary film festival. And there was one that caught my eye called The Hermit of Treig. And it featured Ken, and it was just beautiful. And I could see in it that Ken was a man who wrote and he kept diaries every single day of his life. And I thought, this is a wonderful story that needs to be put down on paper. So I got in touch with the filmmaker, who was Lizzie McKenzie, and She told me that she'd been working in a restaurant in the Highlands of Scotland in a train station, as it happened. And she'd heard about this legendary hermit, Ken, by the kind of remote deer stalkers that were going off into the Scottish wilderness. And they said that he lived in this very remote woodlands next to this loch, Loch Treig. And she went out on foot to seek him out. And they struck up a friendship. And if I'm honest, Ben, I bunny hopped onto the back of that friendship.
As we often do. Exactly.
And I asked Lizzie whether she thought Ken might be up for it. And she took my message to Ken. And we had a bit of back and forth because obviously, you know, it took some time to kind of, you know, slowly, progressively get these messages. And then Ken invited me up to go and stay with him. And we talked about it and we decided to go for it. And that was that, really. So I wrote the book Living with Ken. And it was one of the best experiences of my life.
We know about your journey to Ken. Ken's journey, too, is interesting. If any listener thinks that somehow he was exiled from a nearby Highlands town out into the wilderness for some, you know, as it would have been hundreds over history, it's not true. He grew up in Derbyshire, right? He grew up. What's fascinating about the way you tell his story is that he also grew up in a different time in Britain, too, you know, post-industrial, still working class in many ways. And his upbringing and what he escaped is very much part of the story as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, he grew up as a working class man in Derbyshire, you know, and in that time in the north, you know, we're talking the kind of 50s and 60s, you know, the north of England was still kind of very much dominated by steelworks, coal mines, you know, these kinds of heavy industries, you know, deeply working class culture. And Ken was assaulted on a night out by a skinhead gang in the town of Ripley, really, really badly assaulted. And he was actually put into a coma. And it was when he came round from this coma, having lived up until that point, a very kind of normal working class existence, you know, working on building sites and that sort of thing, going from job to job, that he woke up and he said, no man will ever have mastery over my life again going forward. And he decided that he was going to change his life's path. And that was what he did.
What's remarkable about this, and for listeners, there is a Canadian section of this book that's quite fascinating because it really does begin this journey that leads Ken to spend most of his life by himself in the Highlands. You mentioned it earlier, Will. He decides that if he's going to figure out what it's like to live off the grid or to live in nature, he's going to go to the one place he thinks embodies that, and that happens to be Western and Northern Canada.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's absolutely crazy, Ben, when you think about it. This is a man who is, you know, he's scarcely left Derbyshire. He's done a few trips up to Scotland with work. We, as British people, we've always got this kind of like iconic imagery of what the real, true last wilderness looks like. And for a lot of us, when we think about that in the kind of northern hemisphere, the place that we're pulled towards is Canada, especially the West Coast. And that was how it was for Ken. It's what he'd sort of heard about, he'd read about, he'd seen occasionally on television. And in 1979, he took himself over there after this assault. He saved up all of his money and he just took into the wilderness with his great friend, Roy Stephen. And he landed in Vancouver and together they went into BC, they went to Yukon, they went to the Canadian Rockies, and Ken just fell head over heels in love with the place. Unfortunately, whilst he was out there, his parents passed away. The council had repossessed his family home. He was essentially homeless. And that was when he decided, I've realized I can look after myself. I've realized I've learned some skills. He saved up every single penny he had. He went back again to the West Coast in 1982, BC, Yukon, north to the Arctic Circle, the Northwest Territories, Alaska. He circled back to the Yukon twice. He spent a whole winter in a remote log cabin on his own. And then he had these two incredible trips. One was in out onto the Peace River between BC up to northern Alberta, and another one in the River Teslin in the Yukon, where he literally walked off grid, off the path, into the wilderness, completely on his own, just with one rucksack on his back with a handful of stuff to survive. And he just had this incredible wilderness adventure where somehow, despite the fact it was near suicidal, he came out the other side of it. And after that, he really decided he knew he could make it work and spent the next 40 years of his life living off-grid in the Highlands of Scotland.
There's one incredible scene on his first trip. I believe his friend actually ends up settling in Whitehorse, right in the Yukon. He ends up staying in Canada and marrying and settling down. So there's even still a Canadian thread in this whole story that leads back to the Scottish Highlands. But at one point in that first chapter, on his first day, I think, he gets told by a Mountie to watch out. There's a cougar roaming. And at some point, he confesses that he can't swim. And all these things you think, I can't believe they made it through that that experience. But it really did give him the confidence to become who he was about to become.
Yeah. Do you know what? I mean, just talking about survival stories, one of the most epic ones, and you speak to Cannon, you know, when I tell you this now, I can still see, you know, his eyes flashing in right. his against the light of the fire in his own cabin up there in Scotland when he tells it. It's so vivid and visceral in his memory. To try and save money when he was living in BC, he started like dump diving. So going out onto municipal right. rubbish dumps and looking for food and stuff and clothes and anything that he could find of some use. And there's this story that we tell in the book where basically he sees the rear end of this grizzly bear eating out of the dump. And it suddenly pulls out of this hole, turns around, sees Ken. And Ken by this point had learned that you're not supposed to run away from the bears. You know, having barely seen any before in his life, obviously, because he's a man from the north of England, not from Canada. And he said he just starts backing away, not running, but just keeping his eyes on this bear, backing and backing as he slowly kind of goes down this hill and gets in this merry dance with this bear following after him. And it's not until he's got to the point that the bear is just behind the crest of this hill that he turns around and legs it and just gets out of there with his life. Extraordinary man.
Will Millard is with us this half hour. He is the co-author of a new book out called The Way of the Hermit. It tells the story of Ken Smith, born in Northern England back in 1947. He then finds his way via Canada to the Scottish Highlands, where he's lived essentially on his own, off the grid for decades now. Will, it's interesting looking at sort of, because I guess it would have been hard in some senses to try to make sure that you're always true to his story without actually making it part of a narrative, right? I mean, that's always the challenge in that case. But I guess with so much written material available to you, it wasn't too hard to keep it very much true to Ken.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I was always so wary of that. I wanted to make sure that when we got to the end, that it was his book in his words. God bless him. But Ken has had a hard life. I mean, he's 76 years old now, but he's an old 76, and he's got a few health problems. He survived a few health scares, but then he's also been battered by the wilderness. So, you know, I would have to sit there and read every word of the book, obviously, and then every word of the edits that we made until I knew that he was absolutely happy with what was in there. But of course, I had this incredible personal record to lean back on. And then his slides, he's an incredible photographer. So he had all of these incredible boxes and boxes of slides, and so many of them from Canada that we were able to kind of piece together his journey from. So it was as true as we possibly could fit in within the 80,000 words of a book without it being millions of words, you know?
Indeed. What I enjoyed about it too is, I mean, while there are little moments where you sort of get an insight into Ken's way of thinking about how if you love the land, the land loves you back, and how it's not about withdrawing from society, it's being closer to that, right? What he'd seen when he was away in Canada and so on, then came back to find it again. But there is something really endearing about, in his case, sort of being true to what he knew about himself, to being true to oneself. And I think that's what Ken's story kind of is sort of accepting who you are and then following that path. He says, I could never have married, although he talks about having wished he, you know, that's one thing he didn't get to do, and about just never having been able to be seen essentially, you know, someone who waged for a living, right? That was not him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe there's a side to it that's slightly melancholic, or maybe it's more that it is just about that idea of understanding what compromises we all have to make as people. Ken's the first person to hold his hand up and say, you know, my life isn't perfect. No one's life can be perfect. And there was that element of sadness that he hadn't been able to share those experiences with a partner. Of course, he's now shared them with the world in the book that we've written. But by his own reasoning, he was like, it wouldn't have been fair to have almost, you know, made somebody live in this way, in the way that he decided to live. He knew that if he was going to have to always meet the world, as it were, on his terms, that there was going to be another sacrifice to make. He wasn't going to be a wage man that was going to be dictated to in terms of a boss, but that meant that, and that would mean that he wouldn't have much money, and he was going to have to make personal sacrifices in terms of the stuff he had. He was not going to end up you know, with the big TV and the big house and the big bills to pay.
Right.
But through that, on the other side of the coin, he was like, yeah, I came to realize I didn't actually need any of that stuff to make myself happy. What I needed was the wilderness around me and the natural world. And I wasn't willing to sacrifice that one big elemental happiness that I've found in my life for anything or anyone. But what it does mean, though, is, and I think this is true whenever we talk about hermits or people that pull themselves away from society, it's very easy from kind of our mainstream position of judgments to assume that they're people that perhaps don't like people or shun society. Nothing could be further the truth with Ken. He loves people, and me and him got on amazingly well. It's just that he'd like to see them on his terms, you know? He wants to make sure that if people are going to be invited into his world, that you're a good person and someone that he could get along with. He's actually got a locator beacon with him now.
Right.
So if he's really stuck, he can press the emergency button and, you know, and the kind of emergency authorities will know that there is an issue. And then, of course, he's got his friends. People do drop in and visit him and make sure he's okay. Then, you know, he's really good company. He's very affable.
We talk so much more now about disconnecting. I don't think I ever heard the term, you know, to disconnect when I was growing up in the 80s, you know, but now we talk about it a lot to disconnect from social media and so on. And so your book about Ken and Ken's story kind of lands at an interesting time, even more interesting than I think when Ken set off to kind of cut himself off.
Yeah, totally. You know, and you know, if I could take anything away, well, I have taken lots of things away, but if there was one thing that I would say is, as someone who's had this immense privilege and this window into the man's life, you know, for all of his incredible travels in Canada and all the amazing things he did, I mean, he traveled the length and breadth of the United Kingdom as well before he settled in the Highlands of Scotland. It's just how much you can find if you switch your mind on to what's on your doorstep. Ken now lives and has lived for the last 40 plus years within essentially one square mile of very, very beautiful wilderness. And if you can find that square mile and really learn to appreciate what you have that's right in front of you, then you really can unlock this kind of amazing eternal happiness that you're just not going to find on a device or watching television or through any of those things. If you can learn to love what's immediately around you, then you will be very, very happy. And it's not going to cost you much money either.
No. And that can be a city block or a neighborhood or the Highlands or in the wilds of Northern Scotland. Will, it's a great book. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Ben. My real pleasure.
Monday. And you know what that means? It's time for another round of Monday Morning Quarterback. And today, well, there is a lot to unpack in the Drake and Kendrick Lamar feud.
A lot to unpack here. The two legendary rappers going at it all weekend, each making some very wild accusations about the other. And here to break it all down for us is our Monday Morning QB himself, Mike Muse. Good to see you, man.
What's up, everybody?
Okay, but why are these brothers at each other's throats?
I need some coffee to explain this. I've been up all weekend just going at each other. What we're seeing right now is two of the greatest MCs of this current generation, this current era, really going at each other. There've always been this subliminal shots that they've taken at each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's not often that rap feuds or any sort of musical feud makes it into mainstream media, and the mainstream media pays a lot of attention to it. But over the weekend, not only did I notice this absolutely everywhere, it was even on the BBC. You know, the BBC is usually BBC World News. You know, it's kind of mostly about stuff, sort of politics and so on. They were talking about this Drake and Kendrick Lamar story. So for those of you who don't know who I'm talking about, maybe we start at the beginning. Toronto's own Drake, maybe he got his start on Degrassi, The Next Generation. So Canadians watched him grow up, but he has grown up to become one of the best-selling musical artists in history. He's had 13 number ones on the US Billboard charts, as many as Michael Jackson, more than Madonna, Whitney Houston, and a very, very long list of other superstars. Here's one of them.
You used to call me on my. You used to. Yeah. You used to call me on my cell phone. Late night when you need.
Yeah, he's just had an incredible string of hits over the years, and he's been keeping it up for more than a decade now, more than almost 15 years at this point. But Drake is not without competition for King of the Rap Castle. And perhaps his most legitimate rival is Compton-born and raised
Kendrick Lamar. He's had a little less commercial success, some number ones, did a song with Taylor Swift, but more critical acclaim, including a Pulitzer Prize for music. Now, the two collaborated a little more than a decade ago. That song we played as we came in out of the break, that was actually the two of them on a song called Poetic Justice. So they were collaborators and kind of friends at one point, not anymore. And they've been kind of at each other for a while, but what had been a simmering war boiled over last month as Drake released a song called Push Ups, which takes direct aim at Lamar.
Nobody number one fan. Your first number one, I had to put it in your hand. You can't get booked outside America for now. I'm out in Tokyo because I'm big in Japan. I'm the hit maker, y'all
there you have on. It. So, I mean, these songs are common, and these are like battle songs. And they're essentially on wax, right? They're about who's the better MC, who's had more success. They're meant to be, you know, there are guidelines, right? There are rules to some extent. Well, it erupted this past, like it just absolutely blew over this past week. It turned into a huge feud, both artists releasing a whole bunch of these diss tracks and getting very personal. This one's called Euphoria from Kendrick Lamar.
Euphoria. Them superpowers get neutralized. I can only watch in silence. The famous actor we once knew is looking paranoid and now spiraling. You're moving just like a degenerate. Every antic is feeling distasteful. I calculate you're not as calculated. I can even predict your angles. Fabricating stories on the family front because you heard Mr. Morale. A pathetic
right. So now they're talking about family. This is where it's gotten to at this point. Over the weekend, Drake mentioned Lamar's wife and Lamar mentioned Drake's son. There was an 8-minute diss track that Drake put out called Family Matters that makes allegations about abuse and infidelity involving Lamar and his fiance, Whitney Alford. The song, then Lamar addresses Drake's parents and Drake's parenting, accusing him of having a secret daughter. And I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And one wonders, because if you think back to the 90s, and this was kind of the hip hop view that many people who don't follow hip hop particularly will remember, was Tupac and Biggie. And that ended in violence, right? So you always look at this and think, okay, well, what's going on here? Obviously, Drake is a Canadian, right? So we've paid a lot of attention to him over his career. So we thought we'd call Carl Lamar, no relation to Kendrick. They're spelled differently. He's deputy director of R&B and hip-hop at Billboard magazine, and he joins me now with more on this. Carl, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
Just so for those who don't follow hip-hop closely, and may still, you know, if you say hip-hop, they may think back to the 90s or something. There probably aren't two bigger names in the game over the past decade than Drake and Kendrick Lamar, but for different reasons, but still they are the titans.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. These guys, I mean, listen, Drake made his huge splash So Far Gone 2009. That's really when he catapulted into like mainstream success, especially over here in the US. Best I ever had ended up being a top five hit for him on the Hot 100. And then ever since then, no pun intended, nothing was the same, right? You know, yep. Since then, he's released 13 number one albums on the Billboard 200. And he also is the all-time leader when it comes to Hot 100 hits. So what he's been able to do in the past 15 years is incredible and otherworldly. And, you know, you got to say the same thing about Kendrick Lamar, right? Multi-time Grammy Award winner, Pulitzer Prize winner, acclaimed albums, including Damn Good Kid, Mad City. So, you know, we are so grateful to have these two titans not just represent hip hop but music overall, and just to see them collide to this kind of degree, it's just been amazing.
Yeah. I mean, for Canadian listeners who don't understand, Drake is now perhaps by far the most successful Canadian artist in the history of Billboard, for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can go far enough to even put him top five, top 10, debating on, if you're talking about pure stats alone,
right?
Again, he's behind. I mean, Taylor Swift just officially surpassed him with her new album, but he's officially behind just Taylor Swift, Jay-Z, and the Beatles, the all-time lead on the Billboard 200, as I said, with 13. Yeah. And again, being an all-time leader for Hot 100 hits overall, he has over, I want to say, 300. You know, you don't hear anything like that, whether you're a Canadian artist or an American artist. It is just an incredible stat that it's going to be very, very hard for any artist coming up to try to topple.
Yeah. For listeners who might have followed the way this all works, I mean, of course, what happens now is when an album comes out, almost all the songs end up charting just because they can be streamed and so on. Not like the old days where it was so controlled, you know, right. the labels release the individual's songs and so on. But so if you look back, so you get these two titans seen slightly differently in terms of what it is that they're very good at. Drake's more of a pop artist in some ways. I hope no one takes offense to that. Whereas Kendrick Lamar sort of fits into that long line of incredible lyricists, the Jay-Z's and the Tupac's and the Nas's and so on. And yet here they are at the top of their game. They were collaborators at one point, though. A while back now, but they did collaborate at one point back in the early part of the last decade.
Yeah, they did. They collaborated 2011. Drake tagged in Kendrick to be a part of his Take Care album. That was a sophomore album. And Kendrick Lamar appeared on the Buried Alive interlude. And beyond that, Drake even brought him and A$AP Rocky to his Club Paradise tour that same year. Kendrick returned the favor, had him featured on Poetic Justice, and they even later were both featured on the same song with A$AP Rocky. So all three of these collaborations happened within the same year. So you were having these guys who were at the top of their game, potentially leading the new school of rap, along with J. Cole. We're heading in the right direction, but you can only imagine, right? Egos, it's going to start flaring up.
Yeah.
And I think that was the case when Kendrick Lamar unleashed that fiery bomb in 2013 when he jumped on Big Sean's Control record and just annihilated the rap game and let it be known that I'm not second to anybody. This is a throne. I want it. I don't care if you're Drake, Pusha T, J. Cole, any of my peers. I am calling for the title, and I'm calling for it now. And that's kind of what ignited this feud that's been a decade long.
Yeah. I mean, and these are not new within hip hop, obviously. I mean, I think back, there've been dozens of, I've forgotten many of them now, but there've been some incredible lyrical feuds, as you say, keep them on wax, right? Keep them on wax.
Absolutely. Yeah. Keep it on wax. You know, the last thing we need, especially during this time, you know, in hip hop, is for anything to go outside of the booth. You know, we've had tragedies dating back to, of course, you know, Tupac and Biggie, the West Coast, East Coast beef, you know, and it took so long for us to recover as a culture that to have these two lyrical titans, if they were to engage in something like that, I just said this before, it's not going to necessarily be the main characters. You're going to have casualties outside, whether it's family, friends, and sadly, you know, from a lyrical standpoint, those have already been involved. With Kendrick bringing up allegations about Drake's daughter, Drake kind of igniting that flame on push-ups when he name dropped Kendrick's wife. So, you know, when it comes to rap, especially beef, there aren't necessarily any rules. But I think the one thing that has to be always remembered is to just keep it as lyrical as possible. And it's tough when you're crossing certain boundaries, like I said, name dropping kids, making scathing allegations. And I think that's going to be something that we have to really monitor and pay attention to and just hope it doesn't escalate outside of the booth.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting here to understand is when it became personal, because I was listening to one of Kendrick Lamar's latest, you know, Dear Adonis, who's Drake's son. I'm sorry, that man is your father, right? I mean, that's some pretty... That goes back. I mean, last time I remember hearing stuff like that from major, I know lots of smaller artists like to beef, but from the major guys, the guys making a lot of money, is back to when, you know, Jay-Z, when Tupac and Biggie were, you know, there was a lot of going on back then. But when did it get so personal between these two? Because it feels like they could just go about their own way.
Yeah, totally. I would say it probably got personal when Drake name dropped Kendrick's girlfriend, Whitney. Right. On push-ups. And, you know, for those who may not be familiar, you know, it was the Like That record where Kendrick was a guest appearance on Metro Boomin' and Future's album that just came out this year, where that really ignited the feud, where Kendrick took shots at J. Cole and Drake, hence why Drake felt a need to respond on push-ups. And he chose to name drop Whitney, and then he kind of baited Kendrick to not just come outside, but for Kendrick to return with the same kind of vigor and fire which he did on Euphoria, which he did on 616. And as you just mentioned, the lyrics for Meet the Grams, where things really got bad and ugly, you know, to where he alleged that Drake possibly has a daughter, you know. Yeah.
Karl Lamar is with us this half hour. He is deputy director of R&B and hip hop at Billboard. And we're talking about the ongoing feud, which has really heated up in the last couple of months between Drake and Kendrick Lamar, both of whom are incredibly successful, highly respected in many ways, hip hop artists, depending on what kind of hip hop you like. Karl, is there anything going? I mean, it always felt like when we, you know, I think a lot of Canadians have listened to a lot of hip hop over the years. It was always hard to sort of categorize Drake as a hip hop artist because he's not American. He grew up in a certain way. You know, there was something about the way he was more of like a pop artist in many ways. And I don't mean that to any disrespect to him because he's excellent at it. And Kendrick comes from really, you know, what you think of sort of as the pure roots of hip hop, where, you know, the same areas where NWA came from and so on. Was this always meant to be a conflict because they do come from such different realities?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, Kendrick, he pointed that out on Euphoria. Mm-hmm. He just kind of succinctly said, hey, I hate the way you look. I hate the way you dress. I hate the way you do this and that. And, you know, for a lot of people, especially now when we get into the roots and dive into Black culture, you know, it's unfortunate, even though Drake is a Black man, they look at Kendrick and can easily identify with him versus Drake. Because like you said, he comes from Compton. He comes from struggle. He amplifies voices for Black people in terms of some of the music he released, like All Right, speaks more to the struggle to where many can identify with. Versus Drake, who had a different kind of lifestyle, as you said, you know, doing TV and film when he first came out. To some, feel like he kind of had, he was born with a silver spoon in the case of having somebody like Lil Wayne come in and pick him up. Mm-hmm. But, people have to look back at Drake's history where, you know, when he came up, especially during the mixtape era, when he was crafting like mixtapes like Room for Improvement or Comeback Season, he was kind of a boom bap kind of guy.
Yeah. You know,
he was doing records with Lil Brother, had somebody like a Ninth Wonder who would produce records for him. That was his sound. But he got to a point where he evolved, which is totally okay because artists do that. But I think where a lot of people got lost is that to your point, he went so far gone, no pun intended, into the pop landscape and kind of deviated away from the lyrical soundscapes, the backpack rapper look. And he spoke about that on a lot of new tracks. But again, he credits that to just growing up and learning how to adapt and become a different person. He's not the same person he was 20 years ago. So it's kind of for us fans to decide what we want to do with that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that struck me is that there's a whole new crop of young hip hop artists coming up. I mean, neither Kendrick Lamar nor Drake are young men by hip hop standards. And in this way, they've kind of kept themselves in the public eye. It feels like if you didn't know better, there might be something going. I mean, it feels very personal, but it doesn't necessarily mean, as long as it doesn't get completely out of control, which is the fear, I think. It feels like they can both benefit off this in some way, shape, or form.
You know, it's tough to say, right? Like, right. If you look at the scorecard, in the court of public opinion, Kendrick is up.
Yeah,
undoubtedly Kendrick's up. And you know, when it comes to Drake's legacy, sure, you can. I just name drop pretty much all his Billboard accolades, and that's just barely scratching the surface. But for a lot of people, if Drake was to just bow out or call it a day, as some claim he did on the record he released last night, The Heart Part 6, I think in terms of a hip hop standing, like you said, the purist, they're going to devalue him and kind of bump him down, you know, a couple of tiers, mainly because you think about the ghostwriting allegations that came out. That's already strike one. Strike two was he previously lost in a rap battle to Pusha T.
Right.
That was a blemish on his resume. And then strike three, it's one thing to lose to Kendrick, but to get eviscerated in this kind of fashion, I think he may have to potentially go back into the drawing board and try to figure out, okay, where do I go from here? Especially from a hip hop sense, from a mainstream sense, people are still going to buy his albums. People are still going to support him and go to his shows. But from a hip hop standpoint, he has to reevaluate, where does he go from here?
And that's an interesting dilemma for Drake, because he's always been pulled in two directions, right? I mean, he's crying all the way to the bank, obviously, but he's always been pulled in two directions. One is he has the skills to be respected in hip hop. He also has the mentality to be a really popular pop artist. So what matters more, right? And I think he's always been torn by that, and we're watching it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, a perfect example of that is when he released For All the Dogs. And, you know, every time Drake drops an album, it's a blockbuster event. And even for this album, it was the expectations were so high, where a lot of people were saying, oh, this could be a classic. Drake himself called it a classic during his tour. And when the reception came back, it was so underwhelming. So what he ended up doing, despite the numbers, despite getting another number one single with Slime You Out with SZA, another number one album, he immediately went back into the studio and put out a part two, which was six tracks. Five of them were just lyrical daggers showcasing that he can very much still rap. And this was maybe some of the best rapping he has done in quite some time. So like you said, the skill set has never diminished. But I think he has a tug of war internally where it's like, I want to be this hit maker, and it's what's gotten me to this level, versus do I still continue to look back at my roots and think about the backpackers who I left behind and try to appease to them? It's tough.
It is. Where do you think it goes from here? And what does it tell young hip hop artists as well? That's always the concern too, is you don't necessarily want to see, you don't want to see the adults fighting, right? And these are supposed to be the guys at the top of the game, right?
Yeah, no, I agree 1,000%. But you know, with hip hop, it is such a blood sport, and it's the only genre, like I think everything in life is competitive, but I think with hip hop specifically, you know, for a lot of people, they feel like there could only be one king. And I think that is why Kendrick felt so triggered and felt the need to finally shoot his shot and come at Drake. When you think about Jay-Z and Nas, when Jay-Z put out Takeover in 2001, this was his way of putting down his flag and saying, you know what? I've been hearing murmurs of this guy being on the same level as me. I think it's time for me to showcase my skills and prove why I'm the vastly superior MC. And that was the case with Kendrick here. So for kids coming up, especially wanting to be in hip hop, of course, you don't want to engage in any beef, any lyrical warfare, but it is teaching you to make sure you are equipped for battle, because I have never seen in hip hop history this amount of damage done just from a lyrical standpoint. We have had over 10 diss tracks in less than a month. Seven last week alone. So I think both men should be credited just for having this kind of skill set and to be able to release in such incredible fashion, because before, it would take months at a time to get a diss track.
You have to wait for your next album to come, or maybe there was a mixtape out there, but it wasn't like now they can just, you know, finish them and put them online in a matter of hours. It really does up the game. They have a lot more ammunition now. It really does up the game.
And you know, I think the biggest piece out of all this is, you know, I said this before, it's the advent of social media.
Yeah.
Because now you're getting these reactions in real time, you know, to where it's like you instantly drop that song, like you said, and then 20 minutes later, you're seeing a shit ton of comments and reactions. And that is kind of gauging the temperature of whether you should respond or not. Because if it's bad, then it's like, okay, where do I go from here? What do I do next? And that allows your opponent to kind of game plan as well to decide where they go from here.
Well, it's certainly push both of them to some serious creativity. Carl, watch what happens. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, Ben. Appreciate it.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.